Just a reminder about our Easter season coming up. Easter, the death and resurrection of Christ, is where sin's curse is paid for, and with Christ's resurrection, new creation has begun. It's a highlight of the Christian calendar, so we want to really celebrate it this year. And I think you would have got something as you came in, did you? There were no nods there. After, as we go out, right, yeah. Thanks, Steph. That's okay that you didn't get something as you came in. It's lucky because you would have got two things if you'd got something as you came in, because you're going to get something going out. And it's a description of the Easter weekend with a magnet on it for your fridge. But you get two, so you can give one to your neighbour. 6 months ago, for Christmas time, we gave out flyers. But this time we thought, people took home 10 flyers. But this time we thought, we'll just take home one extra with a magnet on it. So you can actually give it to a friend who doesn't know Christ, and they can stick it on their fridge. And what we're going to do for Easter time is we're going to have a Tenebrae service Thursday evening, and then Friday evening we're going to have, it's called a requiem, an Easter requiem. It's actually a dramatic presentation. It's in silence, and it's very, very, it's a time of deep reflection. It's very profound. And Saturday we'll have some take-home liturgy to do with friends or family, so we can continue to worship on Saturday. But then Sunday is the beginning of new creation, Christ's resurrection. And this is the highlight. And we're really going to celebrate. We're going to have a wonderful breakfast before church, here as a church, and really celebrate. And then come in for a very special time of worship. So I do hope you can stick around for the whole weekend and have a time of praising God and celebrating, but also grieving. It's going to be a wonderful time. I'm going to say this too, and then I'm done. Just to say that our prayer team is, we're going to start something new regarding prayer next week, and we're going to continue it each Sunday, that people will be ready to pray down the front. And so I'm going to come down the front with things to pray for, and it'd be great if everyone from time to time could come down the front with things to pray for, and the prayer team and some elders and pastoral elders and council elders and deacons and others will be here to pray. And I also say at this point, if you'd like to join that prayer team, you don't have to, once a month, once every couple of months, it'd be wonderful. And it'd be great to have a variety of ages. We don't have any young adults in this team ready to pray with people, or even teenagers, or seniors. It'd be great to have a whole variety of ages. So that's going to be great, a wonderful thing that we're starting next week, prayer down the front. Look, let's go. If you're in Australia, and if you ask someone, a Christian person, what's your favourite verse? They'll sometimes say, often say, in my experience, Jesus wept. And they're making a joke to avoid saying a longer passage. I don't know if it's something they do in Canada, but it's common in Australia. And most Christians know that these two words, Jesus wept, it's the shortest verse in the Bible. Those two words there, it's in John chapter 11, verse 35, Jesus wept. And we know it because it's unusual. That's why it sticks in our mind. But these two words, the shortest verse in the Bible, should be known not for their strangeness, but for their profundity and for their depth. It's worthwhile knowing what comes immediately before it. These are the words in verse 34. Jesus said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to Jesus, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus is grieving the death of Lazarus, his friend, as you may know. But even more in those two words, I'm quite sure from John's Gospel, Jesus is grieving the brokenness of the world. "This is my Father's world," Jesus as much as saying with his tears, "but it is broken and decayed by sin." And so Jesus wept. And this week I heard a wise pastor say this. This wise pastor said, being a Christian, in his experience, doesn't reduce our grief. He said in his experience it actually increases it, if anything, because now we know that God's good purposes for this world have been corrupted and this world is decaying. And why does a God who is a loving God delay? Jesus wept. And the teacher in Ecclesiastes, in chapter 4, where we're going to bed down today, is grieving brokenness as he goes on his quest to search for the meaning of life. He grieves the brokenness of the world. Now we know that this teacher's quest is a flawed quest. It's an autonomous quest apart from God. It's flawed quite deeply in many ways. But the teacher's grief at the brokenness of this world is right. And I think we can affirm as Christians just about everything this guy says in chapter 4. And what he's going to do, you can see on the screen there, he's going to speak into four problems in this world and point them out. You can see in there, injustice, work, loneliness, leadership. 1, 2, 3, 4. And we're just going to touch base on them all briefly. But all four discussions are profound as he brings us to grieve rightly the brokenness of the world. And I think this is very, very significant. It seems to me, and I really mean this, I worry about 2013. And I worry about this generation. And it seems to me that this generation, and I'm not just talking about teenagers and young adults, I'm talking about every age, the Facebook generation, I worry deeply that this is a generation that has forgotten how to grieve like Christ grieves. Not that we've forgotten how to be sad, not that we've forgotten how to be depressed, but that we've forgotten to grieve how Christ grieves. The brokenness of the world. Jesus wept. And you know, Mark Zuckerberg, I think I may have said it 6 months ago, he said once, he's a creator of Facebook, right? And he said once, people are more interested in the squirrel in their front yard than global poverty. So Mark Zuckerberg said, we give them the squirrel. And I think a Facebook-saturated world, which is my world and yours, is a world where we become fascinated by the inane, fascinated by the unimportant, all our time caught up with the irrelevant, with the minutiae of my life and my friend's life and another friend who I met once in Korea. And we've lost the capacity, I think, increasingly to grieve as Christ grieves. It's the only explanation I can think of for the appalling legislation that people in Australia and Canada just let go through as the government puts this terrible legislation through that would be unthinkable 20 years ago. And I can only think that we've become disconnected from the important things in life in 2013, this generation. You can see if you agree with me as we continue through this text. Here's the first one. Injustice and oppression. Oppression is devastating. This is his first point. Life appears meaningless in light of oppression. Would you just open up to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, and we'll go deeply into this text. We'll walk through this chapter. Verse 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 1. The teacher says, again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. He says, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. So here's the first problem, oppression, the first out of four. And that word oppression, you can see there in verse 1, it's an important word, it's a Hebrew technical term for when a vulnerable person is being downtrodden and hard done by people who are more powerful. And Martin Luther King, so his point, oppression, this reality of oppression in the world brings despair, brings meaningless. And I was fascinated to read this week. In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr., he preached his I Have a Dream sermon. Remember that sermon, I Have a Dream? And in that sermon, he spoke of a mountain of despair that's built on oppression. A mountain of despair. And he sounds very much at this point like the teacher. And in April that year, in 1963, he'd been incarcerated. And he wasn't there for the birth of his fourth child. And in 1963, his civil rights activists had been marching at his suggestion, and dogs had been set on them. And he spoke about a mountain of despair in light of the oppression that he sees. And if we keep walking through our text here, we see the second half of verse 1, if you have a look at it, despair comes particularly in the face of systemic injustice, which means structural long-term injustice because of structures in society. Have a look at the second half of verse 1 there. Power was on the side of their oppressors. Power was on the side of the oppressors. Vulnerable people didn't have a chance. And then it says they have no comforter. And that phrase is repeated. No one to comfort them. No one to comfort them. So there's no way out. Vulnerable people are trapped. And the teacher grieves rightly at this point. And let me just say something interesting about Ecclesiastes chapter 4 as we try and wind our way through this very, very complex book. That it seems that each of these four problems in Ecclesiastes, he grieves rightly. And we can find our parallels in the book of Proverbs, where Proverbs, he's kind of reflecting the book of Proverbs very deliberately, I think. 2 weeks ago, we noted the connection between the wisdom literature books of Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. So as we fly through this passage today, you might just want to flick about 10 pages back in your Bible to Proverbs and just turn up these Proverbs and see how he's grieving rightly. So Proverbs 28, verse 3, you can just see it. Just quickly find it, if you will. But it speaks about oppression. A ruler who oppresses the poor is like a driving rain. A driving rain that leaves no crops. It's wearisome. It leads to meaninglessness. A driving rain that leaves no crops. That's what oppression does. And he says in verse 2 and 3, it's better to be dead than to face this oppression. And even better, not to be dead, but to never have been born. So it says in verse 2, if you have a look with me, of Ecclesiastes 1, I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not yet seen the evil that is done under the sun. And I think the book of Ecclesiastes, it's existential, it's about our experience today, and I think chapter 4 calls us to grief. And feelings of despair for myself can face me in light of depression today. A lot of oppression today. And one practical example that's very important for us Canadians, I think, is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that our church is going to just gently move towards. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission is in September. It comes to Vancouver in September. And it's an opportunity for Indigenous people who are in residential schools to just tell their story. That's what the Truth and Reconciliation is. It's just a time for Indigenous people who are in residential schools simply to tell their story and for people to go and listen. And we know the history, right? In many cases, parents would be put in prison if they didn't send their killed children to residential schools. It's a systemic injustice, like in this book of Ecclesiastes. And what I was fascinated to learn recently that scholarship shows that among cultures, Indigenous parents among cultures have a close bonding with their children. Just think of the pain of that. In these schools, children weren't allowed to speak their own languages. In these schools, children weren't allowed to use their indigenous names. And if they did use their indigenous names, they would often be beaten brutally. Sisters weren't allowed to speak to brothers. Brothers weren't allowed to speak to sisters. You want the meaninglessness he sees in the world. And he skips quickly now onto work, another very relevant theme for our lives. And now we're going to verse 4 to 6, and if you'd have your eye on the text, it's okay to feel depressed and heavy, I think, in Ecclesiastes. It's a heavy, depressing book. It's facing the realities that the teacher sees in the world, and we have to do that too as Christians. So now, meaninglessness in work. And I read Barbara Ehrenreich this week, and she said regarding work, "Personally, I have nothing against work, particularly when performed quietly and unobtrusively by someone else." And sadness and even depression because of work is a part of the life of every worker from time to time and even often. And the teacher here, he finds a negative, almost destructive rivalry behind work. If you just have a look at verse 4, you'll see what he's saying. He says, "Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind." So envy at work he's referring to, clambering to be on the top of the heap. In illustration, my friend was a corporate lawyer in downtown Sydney, and he quit because he said he didn't want to spend his life in what felt like a sphere of rivalry. And another friend of mine, a trombonist, a professional trombonist, a jazz trombonist who I went through the conservatorium with, he quit jazz trombone because he hated the competition. He just wanted to play music. But it's worth saying too that despair at work and depression at work comes from a number of other places too. Someone in our Bible study struggles at work because of the culture of negativity at work. And another person in our church has difficulty at work because of a difficult boss who's down on them. I'm sure it's not just one person. There's probably 10 people here today that find it difficult with a difficult boss. We think of motherhood. Another day stuck in the house. Every mother feels that. But for high school students as well, work can be difficult. I found high school very difficult personally. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 is for high school students as well. But this is very significant. Work is a dominant part of our lives. It dominates our time, it dominates our thoughts, and when it isn't going well, it leads really quickly to sadness and depression. And the teacher rightly grieves this. In the beginning, as you and I know, work was a good part of God's creation. In Genesis chapter 2, he created humankind and placed us in the garden. It said to keep it and to till it and to work in it. And in Genesis chapter 3, because of sin, it says, now by the sweat of your brow, you'll till the soil. God says to Adam, once sin's come into the world. So work is supposed to be joyful because of sin's curse, the sin of humankind. It's become corrupted and decayed. So the teacher is right to grieve folly and foolishness in work. And so his response is, what is the point of working? And he says, he quotes a parable. If you have a look at verse 5, he quotes a parable from his culture on the foolishness of laziness. And the book of Proverbs has the foolishness of laziness. It's probably said about 10 times through the book of Proverbs. But the teacher, he doesn't quite buy it. Verse 5, he almost quotes Proverbs. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. That is to say, if you don't work, you'll end up poor and fading away. So don't be lazy. But the teacher thinks to himself, why work with all this depression surrounding work? So he says in verse 6, better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. Why bother working, since work is such drudgery? So the author wants us to sit with this. We're not supposed to find quick answers. We're supposed to feel a bit down in Ecclesiastes. So we won't let ourselves off the hook. We'll just immerse ourselves in some sadness. But then problem 3, and I'm not going to speak about this in general, I'm just going to skip through it, but if you can just kind of see in your Bible, Ecclesiastes 4, from verse 7 to 12, just kind of put your fingers there and skim your eye over it. But this time it's about isolation and loneliness, that isolation is cruel. Our family have been immigrants in two directions. We know what isolation feels like. Isolation's hard. And the teacher observes this. He's always observing. And he says, this too is meaningless. This too is a vapor. It's a chasing after the wind. And probably the most famous verse in the chapter comes in this section, the problem of loneliness. And it's there in verse 12. And it's quoted in every second marriage celebration. Verse 12 of Proverbs chapter 4, the cord of three strands. Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And it's not talking about marriage, of course. It's not talking about a wedding, even though it might sound like it. It's really talking about safety in numbers, that you're better to have friends and relatives so you can protect one another. Protect one another against violence. Protect one another against starvation in a time of hunger or famine. Protect one another against false accusations in the law courts. And that's what it's talking about. Strength in numbers. Isolation is meaninglessness, the teacher says as he observes the world. So that's problem number 3. Now on to problem number 4. Leadership. I think this week as I was looking on the text, problem number 4 is the one that struck me most freshly. Because I don't know that I've ever really noticed this theme before in Scripture. That leadership is a fool's game. It's so interesting. Many of us here are leaders. We've got small business owners. We've got teachers. Teachers are leaders in the classroom. We've got CEOs. We've got parents. We've got mothers, fathers, they're leaders. We've got leaders of ministries here in the church. We've got professional managers. And I think every seasoned leader knows two truths about leadership. I think every parent knows this as well. Here's two truths that every seasoned leader knows. First, that every leader is broken and makes huge mistakes. And this is what the teacher is about to say. Every leader is broken and makes huge mistakes. And second, even if a leader doesn't make a mistake, even if you're a perfect leader, and no one is, everyone makes a mistake, but even if you could be perfect, which is not possible, many people will still not like you. And this is exactly what the teacher says here. It's so interesting. Take a look at this, leaders. So in the passage here is a leader who won't listen. Have a look at this. That's his mistake. Here's a leader who won't listen. Have a look at verse 13. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. So the old king won't take advice. So that, and this is interesting because the importance of leaders who listen is a really big theme of the book of Proverbs. It's really, I mean, Proverbs chapter 20, if you want to quickly flick back in verse 18. Proverbs 20, 18. The author says, make plans by seeking advice. It's probably instruction for a king or for an official. Make plans by seeking advice. If you wage war, obtain guidance. So here's wisdom for leaders to listen well and to take advice. And then it says here back in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 12, here is a young man who does listen and he rises to be king. But then in verse 13, we meet a poor, so this poor but wise youth, it says in verse 13. And then in verse 14, he goes from prison to the throne because he listened well. He was a wise young leader and he listened really well. And even though he was in jail, he rose to be king because he was a wise leader and he listened really well. And it was really interesting for me to see this week because a mentor of mine, my best mentor, sent me a quote just recently right along these lines. It's there on the screen. And the golden rule of leadership, listen to others as you would have them listen to you. And then the mentor wrote, more easily said than done, I find. Listen to others as you would have them listen to you. It's so wise. So there is a lesson in the passage. There's some wisdom there from our teacher. Okay, point taken. However, the next point is, no matter how well a leader listens, if you're the perfect listener, you'll still be disliked, at least by some. And have a look at verse 16. This is what it says. Verse 16, those who came later were not pleased with their successor. So even good leadership, he says, is a vapor, a striving after the wind. Dan Lander's book on leadership. Dan Lander is a Christian leader, and he wrote Leading with a Limp, and it was recommended to me by this same mentor as the best book on leadership he's ever read, and it's a stunning book. And Dan Lander writes on leadership in the opening page, quote unquote, there is nothing more difficult than leading. And he adds on the same page, if you're a leader, you're in for the battle of your life. Nothing comes easily. Enemies outnumber allies, and the terrain keeps shifting under your feet. Does that ring true? And that's what this fourth problem is all about in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And all us leaders here know this is right, and parents know it's right. And Dan Lander continues, and he says, leadership has been described as wearing a bullseye on your chest during hunting season. And that's part of the point of Ecclesiastes chapter 4 at the end. But then, for me personally, the greatest grief in leadership is this. Here's the greatest grief in leadership for me personally. The greatest grief in leadership for me is the damage that I cause. The wounds that I create through my own brokenness and foolishness. And this is the stuff that keeps me awake at night more than any other thing in leadership. Leaders cause so much damage. And Dan Lander writes, prepare now to admit to your staff that you are the organization's chief sinner. We wound people as leaders. Leaders are powerful, and I hurt others through my sinful, broken, and self-seeking leadership. And I wound people especially when I feel wounded myself. And this broken old ruler in this passage, the broken old king who can no longer take advice there, is a picture of all of us leaders. And the more often and the more honestly we can face our brokenness and sinfulness as leaders, the safer we will be for others. Well, let's try and wrap up and summarize and pull it together. I know it's been a bit of a depressing sermon. We started off with Indigenous issues, then we went to work, then we went to leadership. But it's a depressing text. And the teacher is teaching us to grieve what God grieves. And perhaps, and we know this about Ecclesiastes, right, that he's not anchored in God like he could be. We know that. We know his boat drifts on the current, perhaps more than it should. We know that about this guy. But he's right to grieve these things and grieve them deeply. And he's right not to be distracted by the inane, not to be distracted by Mark Zuckerberg's squirrels. He's right. Christians have got to grieve the stuff that Christ grieves. So I'd like to go and quote from Nikolaus Walterstorff now. It's a long quote. It's the longest quote I've ever done in church here, but it's a wonderful quote. And it's on grieving what Christ grieves. Walterstorff says, "Blessed are those who mourn." What can it mean? One can understand why Jesus hails those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, but why he hails the merciful, why he hails the pure in heart, why he hails the peacemakers, why he hails those who endure under persecution. These are qualities of character which belong to the life of the kingdom. But why does he hail the mourners of the world? Why cheer tears? It must be that mourning is also a quality of character that belongs to the life of his realm. Who then are the mourners? The mourners are those, and I love this, the mourners are those who have caught a glimpse of God's new day, who ache with all their being for that day's coming, and who break out into tears when confronted with its absence. The mourners are the ones who realize that in God's realm of peace there is no one blind, and who ache whenever they see someone unseeing. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm there is no one hungry, and who ache whenever they see someone starving. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm there is no one falsely accused, and who ache whenever they see someone imprisoned unjustly. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm there is no one who fails to see God, and who ache whenever they see someone unbelieving. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm there is no one who suffers oppression, and who ache whenever they see someone beat down. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm there is no one without dignity, and who ache whenever they see someone treated with indignity. They are the ones who realize that in God's realm of peace there is neither death nor tears, and who ache whenever they see someone crying tears over death. And then Nikolaus Walterstorff concludes, the mourners are aching visionaries. The mourners are aching visionaries. So to conclude, the teacher's grief in this passage, it moves us towards Easter. It's in the cross, sin's curse is defeated, and in Christ's resurrection, new creation has begun. When Christ has risen from the dead, and I love this thought, when Christ was risen from the dead by God, one little piece of the new era to come, the era when this world is restored, one little piece of that future era was walking around in this decaying era. Jesus resurrected was the first fruits of the new creation. 1 Corinthians 15:20 says that. Martin Luther King, to finish with him, in his I Have a Dream sermon, he speaks of Christ coming and is quoting Isaiah 40. And he says this, "I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be laid low. The rough places will be made plains, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all the flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the south with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope." Amen.